I remember the first time I came across in my reading the word tessellation. I thought it was beautiful, and upon looking it up in my dictionary, found that it means to form of small squares or blocks or tiles in an order of some kind, as forming a picture in a mosaic. Tessellation is the art or practice of tessellating, of forming a pattern or picture of small individual pieces. A good speaker is a tessellator. He fashions a mosaic in the minds of his listeners by placing one piece at a time until the picture is finally complete. Then he gives us a glimpse of the finished picture in his closing remarks. We might say that in his opening remarks he shows us the matrix which gives order and form to a thing, which serves to enclose it. He shows us where the mosaic is going to be formed, the shape or need of that which is to be formed. Then, in order, one piece at a time, he fashions the picture for us. It's important when communicating with others that we keep things in order. We don't want it to be plodding or pedestrian, tiresome or boring, of course. Each of the small bits that we use to form the picture should have interest of its own, if at all possible. We've all heard the truly great storyteller who tells the story in such a way that each of the parts leading up to the punchline is hilarious in itself. By the time we reach the climax of the story, we're convulsed in helpless laughter. It was a mosaic, all right, and he placed the bits in their proper order so that we could follow him perfectly. But each of the bits was a work of art in its own right. The finished product is a masterpiece. Now, we're not all endowed with the rare and wonderful talent of the gifted and polished storyteller, but we can make our speech in the same way. The whole may be more than the sum of its parts, but its overall quality and integrity will depend on the quality and integrity of each of its parts. As we prepare our speech, we can prepare the parts themselves so that they follow a logical order and so that each of the parts is in itself of interest, importance, or humor. It's like writing a book. The book has, let's say, 12 chapters. Together, they follow a path or tessellation toward the conclusion, the idea behind the book itself. But each of the chapters must be of interest if we want the reader to finish. It's a very common sense idea, nothing at all new about it, but often a person with an idea for a talk will overlook the opportunity to make the journey just as interesting as the destination. And I think that's part of the responsibility of a good speaker. The cardinal sin of the communicator is to be uninteresting. It's the worst sin in selling. And that's what the speaker's doing. He's selling an idea or a theme or a story to his listeners. And it's his duty to be interesting in all parts of that story. And that's where burning the midnight oil comes into the picture. A good friend of mine told me the other day that he had accepted a speaking engagement to the local Rotary Club. He asked me if I had any ideas and went on to say that he would probably lie awake all night before the day he was to give the speech, worrying about it. I told him that was about the best way I knew of to ruin it. Think about it, of course. When we have a speech coming up, we can't help but think about it. It worries our mind like a puppy with an old shoe. I've got a commencement address coming up next Sunday. I told my friend to give it a lot of thought, remember to stick to a subject he was intimately familiar with, tie it to the interest of the members of the club, then it's my habit to forget all about it and get a good night's sleep the night before the speech. Set the alarm clock to wake up early, earlier than usual. Get up, make a fresh pot of coffee, then sit down at your desk and outline the talk you're to give. The method works like a charm for me. I've given the talk a lot of thought. I've done my homework. I've let it do some good cooking, some good percolating in my subconscious. Then, by getting up early on the actual day of the speech, I find it flows out of my mind and onto the paper almost faster than I can write. And there, it's done. There's the idea. There are the tiles that fit in order into the picture. And finally, the complete picture. The whole is good. The parts are good. It will be a good, interesting speech. One last check to make sure the parts are in order. Do they lead in an interesting but unbroken tessellation to the complete picture I want to make? They do. Then I put the outline in my pocket, a briefcase, and try to forget about it until lunchtime. Now, during coffee at lunch, I will go over it again, perhaps adding something, maybe taking something out, the final touches. Then, all is set. Now, quite often, at lunch or dinner or at a conversational gathering before your talk, you'll pick up several ideas to incorporate into your talk, perhaps at the beginning, to better fit it into the group you're addressing. Sometimes I note these ideas on a separate sheet of paper or back of an envelope and put it with my notes on top where I'll be sure to see it and remember it. Then, I do the best I can to make an interesting talk, keeping in mind that while I can take my subject seriously and my craft, I should never take myself seriously. I should keep a good perspective and a sense of humor. If you tend to be an orderly person naturally, you pick up after yourself, like to keep things in neat stacks and know where everything is, chances are you'll put your talk in the proper order without even thinking about it. But if you're the sloppy type, towel on the floor after a shower, leaving cabinet doors open, habitually late for meetings, you'd better take special pains with your speech. There, order is important. Thank you. As a Toastmaster, you should try to find a subject on which you're reasonably well-informed and should select some matter on which you have definite feelings and convictions. I don't think these two important points can be overstressed, most especially the latter. A matter on which you have definite feelings and convictions. You know, that's also a rule for good creative writing. If you want to transmit an emotional feeling or content along with what you're writing or speaking about, it's important that your subject be something that's very meaningful to you. Over the years, I've had many people write and visit me to tell me that they want to become public speakers, that they have a tremendous urge to get up before a group of people and talk. I always ask them the same question. What do you want to say? As often as not, it's answered with a long pause and a thousand-yard stare. They want to be speakers, but they don't have anything to say. My suggestion has been for them to get excited about something and then start talking about that. I only make speeches on subjects in which I have a deep personal interest and to which I've devoted many years of reading and research. When a program chairman suggests that I talk on a subject of his selection and it's something in which I have no particular interest, I decline. Maybe that makes me less than a true professional speaker, but unless I've got something I want to talk about, I don't want to talk at all. May I suggest that you do the same? You'll seldom, if ever, be a boring speaker on something in which you're deeply interested, on something that moves you, that's important to you. If you give the idea some thought, you'll find there are several, indeed a whole spectrum of subjects in which you're very much interested. From your career to your hobbies and sports, I know one of America's most famous dentists who can lecture with enthusiasm on bone fishing, but he's also lectured all over the world, including in Russia, on his pet subject, which is occlusal rehabilitation. He's my old friend and fishing partner, Dr. L.D. Pankey, and his seminars for dentists are famous all over the world. There's a subject that can make all of us jump up and down and get excited about. There's something we do or believe in that we want to tell other people about, and perhaps get them interested in the same thing. As long as we follow the general rules of putting a speech together and stick to our pet subject, we'll make interesting speeches. We'll be asked to come back. In preparing a speech, I'm of the Stewart variety. That is, as the day of the speech approaches, I find it difficult to get it out of my mind for very long periods. As I've mentioned in an earlier message, it tends to worry my mind like a puppy with a slipper. The day before my speech, my mind is turning over a number of ideas, and I'll begin to put a folder together for that particular talk. Pick the theme of your speech and write it out in one sentence or two. On it hangs the opening and the closing of your talk. Next, make a general outline according to your own system and plan as to timing. If the speech is to be for Toastmasters and you need a few extra minutes, notify the Toastmaster of the day in advance. But with a little extra effort, you can cover virtually any subject matter in the regular time allowed. It takes more work. Short speeches are harder to prepare and deliver, as I'm sure you know, than the long, rambling kind which are dreaded by everyone but the speakers. And after you've got your outline together, rehearse. You don't want to commit the speech to memory word for word, but you do want to get the sequence of your outline well in mind so that you can comfortably move from one picture to the next as your picture forms in the minds of your listeners. Remember to carefully avoid anything at all that will appear artificial and affected. Be natural. You have something to give that's unique. Give it in your own way. As to gestures, well, I feel that the proper gestures will come of their own accord, especially with experience, as you lose yourself in your subject. When you're speaking to a friend or loved one about something important, you don't need to be concerned about gestures, yet chances are you gesticulate almost constantly. Let them come naturally, and they'll look natural. Force them, and they'll look forced and wooden. If you'll relax, your habits will take care of your gestures for you. You can forget all about them. If you use a lectern, for heaven's sake, don't lean on it. You can rest after your speech. Stand erect. If you want to rest your hands lightly on the lectern from time to time as it comes naturally, that's fine. But don't grip it as a barrier between you and your audience. Don't play or fool with it or with anything else. It's a distraction. And soon your audience is so enwrapped in whatever your hands are doing, they're not even listening to you. Forget your hands, and they'll take care of themselves, as they have a habit of doing all day long. Look at your hands now. What are they doing? See, no one's conscious of them. Forget them. And of all things, don't rock forward on the balls of your feet. I know a speaker who does that, and it's the most disconcerting thing I've ever seen. Keep in mind that you, as a person, should be only the backdrop. It's what you're saying that's important. Think of yourself as you think of the well-dressed person. The clothes of the truly well-dressed person are a background compliment to him. They're never of special notice themselves. Just as a well-dressed man would never wear a tie or jacket that calls out in a loud and raucous voice, "Look at me," the good speaker does nothing to distract from the thoughts, the ideas he's trying to get across. He tends to disappear as his thoughts fill the minds of his listeners. Unnatural movements of any kind destroy that. Be yourself. But dress simply and conservatively, unless the nature of your speech demands otherwise. My old pal Parky Parkinson of Kansas City, who's made several thousand speeches in his time, wears a red tie. It's his trademark. But a red tie with a conservative suit, a dark jacket, looks fine. If it had a picture of a rocket ship on it, well, that would be a distraction, or low class, as an old friend of mine used to say. To recap briefly, speak about what's important to you. Your anger or enthusiasm or interest will come through and infect your audience. Spend some time in preparation and prepare an outline, the points of which you make a point of learning. I frequently use a small list of points I want to make in the order in which I want to make them. And be natural, unless you've got some bad natural habits like the man who rocks up on the balls of his feet. Your friends in Toastmasters will quickly disabuse you of any bad habits you might have. And dress for the occasion with conservative good taste, unless the subject matter calls for a special outfit. Thank you. Visual aids, if they're called for, can be tremendously effective if they're handled properly. My good friend Dr. Derm Barrett, the well-known management consultant from Canada, arranges his visual aids well before the people come to the room in which he's to speak. Each of the aids is covered, and they're placed at strategic vantage points around the room or stage, depending on the size of the audience. They have printed on them in big, legible letters very important points Derm is going to make during his talk. They're points he wants to emphasize and give his audience a chance to make notes on. It's tremendously effective. I've sat enthralled during his talks on good management, management by objectives and time control, and made voluminous notes from his visual boards around the room. He'll have a main point in very large printing at the top of a board, then the lesser or substantiating points listed under it, 1, 2, and 3 order, and so on. If you use slides or an overhead projector, make certain that the printing on the slides is large enough for the people in the back of the room to read. Keep in mind that not everyone has the vision of a peregrine falcon. I've sat in the back of the room and developed a splitting headache from trying in vain to read small, typescript or small print on the screen during a slide presentation. Walk to the back of the room and see if someone not familiar with your slides can read them with ease. You should check the microphone the same way. Strive for simplicity. Put only on visuals information that is required to be on visuals or helpful to your audience, such as statistical material, main points of your talk, and so on. Make sure you follow a consistent style and develop a smooth continuity. Remember that word tessellation. You want to place one interesting tile after another until the picture is complete. Make the composition of the visual pleasing and easy on the eyes, but that can be done without expensive artwork. You can do it yourself. Go easy with colors unless you have to make a special effect or want to throw in a little variety to grab their attention. And it's a good idea to introduce your visuals before springing them on the audience, unless, again, you want to shock or surprise them in some way. The simpler the visual aids are, the better as a rule. But that's not always possible, of course. If your presentation is a new heart operation or a discussion of the wheel assembly of a new jet aircraft, it's not all that easy to keep simple. But the simpler, the better. Visuals are not meant to confuse or impress people. They're an additional tool in the business of communication, and they can be wonderfully effective if they're needed and properly done. If funny visuals are used from time to time to add to the interest of your presentation, be sure they're secondary to your message, unless you're making a funny presentation. Humor should be a supportive adjunct to a presentation. It should have some kind of relationship to your subject so that it's the subject you're talking about that will remain uppermost in the minds of your listeners. In determining whether or not you should employ visuals in your presentation, you should ask or might ask this question. Will it help me do a better job of communicating, of transferring the subject in order and intact from my mind to the minds of my listeners? If so, use visuals. If not, forget them. A large pad of paper with a heavy marker can be effective. For this, you need a lavalier microphone, one that hangs around your neck so that when you move to the big pad, your microphone will go with you. That's not necessary if you're speaking to a very small group and they can clearly hear you without a mic. Turn your head toward them when speaking, however, or they'll miss what you say. If you use this method of illustration, remember to print or sketch large enough so that everyone, especially the people in the back of the room, can clearly see and understand what you're up to. Print or sketch very large, remembering that some people have difficulty seeing, just as people have difficulty hearing. If you're a good printer or cartoonist, this is an especially effective ploy. If you can't print very well, it would pay to practice or have your cards made up ahead of time and kept covered until you need them. Action of that kind adds animation and movement to your presentation, both desirable when they're a part of the presentation. Getting a beautiful and shapely girl to turn the pages of your large pad or board presentation is an exercise in futility. Everyone will be looking at the girl and ignoring your posters and your material. Should I use visual aids? Will they add to my presentation? Will they help me do a better job of communicating? If so, fine. If not, forget them. Thank you. There's no such thing as an unimportant speech. Some are more important than others, perhaps. I imagine that addressing the joint houses of Congress or the United Nations General Assembly might be considered more important than a Monday morning sales meeting, but the principles of the act remain the same. You are there to impart useful or important information in an interesting and memorable way. The opening, the middle, and the end should be much the same in structure, and you have listeners. We're all familiar with the axiom of show business. There are no small parts. There are just small actors. To the good actor, even the smallest part will receive his very best, and I think that's also true with professionals of all kinds. In speaking before a group of people, it's important that you're involved with your subject matter, as we brought out before, that you spend a lot of time with it and feel comfortable with it. Approach your presentation with the proper attitude, the attitude of calm command. You're in charge, and while you should keep your sense of humor and your proper perspective, remembering that while you can take your subject and your act seriously, you should not take yourself seriously. Look at your audience and see them as individuals and speak to them as individuals. Project your voice so that it will comfortably reach the people in the last row. If you use a microphone, get within range of it, without crowding it, so that your voice may be distorted and you pop your peas. I made a speech in New York recently, and prior to my being introduced, an official of the meeting stood to make a couple of important awards. These awards involved giving the background and explaining the achievements of the people receiving them. But the speaker stood much too far back from the microphone. He gave the impression that he didn't know the mic was there. The result was that no one, not even those of us at the head table, were able to clearly hear what he had to say. He was talking to himself. It was a shame, especially so, since what he had to say was so important to everyone concerned, and especially to those who were being honored. What could have been a memorable occasion was a complete bust. Why didn't the man in his 40s know how to use a microphone? Why did he think that his voice without the mic would carry to the audience? Yes, someone should have told him no one could hear him. If I'd been within range, I would have, but no one did. The good speaker, like the good golfer, has to do a number of things correctly all at the same time if he's to have a successful shot. He should be prepared, no matter how unimportant the affair might seem to him. He should know his subject. He should have the right attitude, not say too much. He should project his voice, or if he's using a microphone, use it properly and not fade in and out as he moves about. He should enunciate his words clearly and watch his rate of delivery, not too fast, not too slow. He shouldn't worry about occasional stumbles or slips of the tongue. He should gesture naturally, appear confident, and be interesting. Yes, it sounds like a big order. It is a big order. But it's not a bit tougher than making a good golf shot. It takes time and practice. Until one day you don't have to think about anything at all except the people and your subject, and you'll make a great speech. Can you imagine a golfer standing so far back from the ball that he can't reach it? Or so close that he has to swing at his feet? Can you imagine a good golfer aiming in the wrong direction or varying his club and effort with the distance of the shot to be made? No, he's natural, he's comfortable, unhurried but not dawdling, and he knows the game. It's true that there are some audiences we'd rather speak before than others. Some make us a bit tense. Others warm us with their enthusiasm and hospitality. We feel right at home with them. Speaking before your good friends and cohorts at Toastmasters is one thing, even though you know they're being critical and watching for mistakes. A church group is different, as is a service club or professional organization. Speaking before attorneys or physicians is different from speaking before an insurance salesman or a union meeting, and each group will affect you slightly differently. Some are cool and a bit distant and give you the initial impression that they're not at all sure they're glad they have to listen to you. Quite often you're going on late. The dinner took forever. The service people were slow. The people had been sitting a long time, and they're restless and in need of the restroom. There was too much business, reading of minutes, election of new officers, each of whom had to make a speech of his own. You're tired. It's been a long day, and after the meal and all that business of the meeting, you suddenly find that you've lost all interest in what you were going to talk about. You wish you were home. Anywhere but there. You dread the thought of having to stand up and make a speech. And that's when you remember the line, "There are no small parts, just small actors." That's where they separate the professionals from the amateurs. Because you can get up and make a speech that will hold the real interest and attention of every person in the room, and they'll be sorry to see you stop. Don't let that stop you from stopping, however, and they'll give you a standing ovation. Well, then it's all worth it, isn't it? You go home satisfied and glad you did such a fine job. It's not such a bad business after all. And isn't it great to know how to deliver a good speech? Thank you.